Thank you, board operator Yount, for being here today and all that stuff. Thank you, listeners, and we will be back next week. I think Jesse Bliss is our host next week. Bye-bye.
And I should say I'm loud, say I'm clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On August 1st, Russia released 16 political prisoners from its dungeons, or penal colonies, in a large and complex prisoner exchange involving negotiations between Russian, American, and German heads of state. Americans Ivan Gershkovich and Paul Whelan, British-Russian Vladimir Kara-Murza, and Russians Ilya Yashin, Oleg Orlov, and others were exchanged for the Russian assassin Viktor Krasikov, who was serving a life sentence in Germany for assassinating a Chechen target in Berlin, as well as several Russian spies, some of whom had been monitoring the Russian opposition abroad. It's impossible not to rejoice at the release of 16 political prisoners of Putin, but more than 1,000 remain in prison. Millions remain in Russia. Of the prisoners, Ilya Yashin was forcibly removed from Russia and exchanged against his will. Vladimir Kara-Murza has vowed to return to Russia. Though there had been a huge campaign by the Wall Street Journal to release their reporter, Gershkovich, it wasn't public pressure by international solidarity campaigns that secured the release of Putin's political prisoners. That came about through complex negotiations between states. What will this mean for those left behind? We'll ask our guests, Ilya Budraitskis and Grusha Galayeva. We'll also ask for your support when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Our guests today, Russian dissident activists and scholars Ilya Budraitskis and Grusha Galayeva, last spoke to us just after the Marxist critic Boris Kagarlitsky lost his appeal and was sent to a penal colony to serve 5 years on the absurd charge of justifying terrorism. And a few days after that, Alexei Navalny died after, in Ilya's words, having been subjected to a slow, cowardly murder drawn out over many months. Today, we're going to get their views about the August 1 multi-prisoner exchange and ask what it represents. As I said in the intro, 16 have been exchanged, more than 1,000 remain in prison, and millions remain in Russia. Of the Russian prisoners, Ilya Yashin was forcibly removed from Russia and exchanged against his will. Vladimir Kara-Murza has vowed to return to Russia. We're going to get more about the politically courageous Russians who were held and now exchanged for speaking out against Putin's savage war in Ukraine, like Yashin, Orlov, and Kara-Murza. We'll also ask what it means for Putin. Will he continue to hold hostage human assets to be exchanged? Does the timing of the exchange signal Putin favors a Harris presidency over another Trump term? We'll look at all of these questions. My guest, Ilya Budraitskis, is a political theorist and activist previously based in Moscow and joined the UC Berkeley campus as a visiting scholar in 2023. He's the author of Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia, published by Verso in 2022. And he writes regularly for Jacobin, Open Democracy, and many other outlets. He's a member of the editorial board of Postly Media and has his own Telegram channel, Brave New World. And Grusha Galayeva is the managing editor of Postly Media. She's the author of many articles, including Navalny and Us, Adorno and the Kremlin, Did Lenin Create Ukraine, On the Right of Nations to Self-Determination and Marxism. And she's joining us today as well. So before we start, I was hoping that I could just read a very small part of a statement that appears now on the website on change.org for the International Campaign to Free Boris Kagarlitsky. And it was written by a Russian oppositionist who just calls himself B. He said, instead of those who were exchanged, the ones that needed to be exchanged were prisoners who were in precarious health and being tortured through sleep deprivation, lack of medication to treat serious conditions, and held in punishment cells. And he says, it is they who must be saved and not the political activists who remained in Russia with full understanding of what threatens them. Political activists who understood that the day after the exchange, the authorities would say that we exchanged our spies for their spies. Political activists who understood how Russian politics are conducted in Russia. 16 lives have been saved, but what should millions do? How and when should they get their freedom? In the world of Russian politics that will greet those released via exile today, there's no answer to this question. They only have the experience of two fruitless years, which has reduced politics to watching videos produced in abundance by opposition talking heads on YouTube, the experience of a mistake that can form the basis of truth. These days, everyone has been talking about how we can save as many prisoners of Russian prisons as possible, how we want to get foreign agents Boris Kagarlitsky, Azat Miftakhov, Daria Kazareva, and others released. But we should all think about why foreign agent Boris Kagarlitsky did not leave Russia, neither before a criminal case was initiated against him, nor after his release from the pretrial detention center after the initial verdict. No matter how wonderful the salvation of individual people may be, it should not turn into a general soul-saving attitude. Take as much as possible out of Russia and advise those who remain to wait it out, carefully monitor their health, eat a lot, toughen up, and read more books in anticipation of the inevitable. We need to save everyone, not each one. We need universal liberation. We need a free Russia, no matter how glad we are for the release of some of its prisoners. Well, I didn't really mean to read that much, but it's so powerful. So I think that's a really good way to welcome both of you, and let's get started. So since we are just talking about the exchange, we should begin with that itself. Like, it began years ago, apparently was to have included Alexei Navalny, and it was negotiated behind closed doors. Can you tell us, maybe you could start, Ilya, on what happened, who the exchange were, and what threat they represented?
So for now, the whole story is a bit unclear, because it seems that it was the very serious desire of Putin to release Viktor Krasikov, who is a colonel of the Federal Security Service and used to be part of the close milieu of Putin's friends. Also, he is a professional killer. And probably he is a very valuable person for Putin. So that's why, since Krasikov was arrested in Germany, Putin was interested to exchange him to some American or European citizens. Probably Ivan Gershkovich was arrested exactly for this purpose, to be like the person who could be exchanged for Krasikov. But the problem was that Krasikov was arrested not by Americans, but by Germans, and he was in German prison. So that's why Germany was against this exchange for some period of time. And then the idea to include Alexei Navalny to this process somehow appeared, probably with the help of Germany, because you know that Alexei Navalny, like a few years ago, he was in Germany after he was poisoned in Russia and so on. So he became like very well known in Germany and also among the German political elite. That's how this process started, like how to bring together some prominent Russian political prisoners and the citizens of US and Germany and exchange them to Krasikov and probably some other Russian spies. And if you remember the Putin's interview to Tucker Carlson, I think it was in spring of this year, Putin openly said that he is ready to exchange Gershkovich for Krasikov. So you see that this was the process initiated by different states, let's say, who wanted to take back their citizens, and the Russian political prisoners somehow were included in this process because it was very complicated and because it was not clear what is the real value of one citizen to another citizen, let's say, of value of Krasikov and value of, for example, Gershkovich or Whelan.
And also, it's pretty interesting because it seems like apart from Krasikov, who, as you're saying, was the main person Putin wanted, they included a family of Russian spies who had been in Argentina and I think then in Slovenia. I'm not quite sure. Yeah, Slovenia. And spies who were probably minor spies, not even in danger of getting caught, but just to round out more and more. We don't really know, but that's kind of, you know, certainly see spy novels written about this. Did you want to come in on this, Grusha, as well, on something about the exchange?
Continue Ilya's thought about who were the people who initiated this exchange and what was at stake. I think it is very important to understand that in this exchange, it was actually Russians who were exchanged for other Russians. And that brings Putin in a very strong position because you see, these were his spies and at the same time, these were his hostages. So most of them, most of the people exchanged either had dual citizenship or were Russian citizens.
With very few exceptions.
Exactly, very few exceptions. And just in that particular light, we can see how Russia is, in a way, trying to revive the Cold War practice of exchanging spies for dissidents, as it has been the case, or as it was the case in the late 70s and early 80s, as you well know. So we can see that Putin is trying to get back to this position of Cold War, where Russia was the great empire that could really negotiate with the United States directly. So this puts him in this position that he was striving for a long time. Because his war in Ukraine, as he claims, is not the war against Ukraine. It is the war that is waged by the West against Russia. And now, in this exchange, the West is finally negotiating with him directly.
That's a really good point. Let me ask Ilya, too, because you wrote in one of your Telegram posts that there were several dimensions to the exchange, and Grusha's just introduced a really important new one that is hearkening back into history, and perhaps even this notion that Putin represents the kind of Russia or Russian Empire that was then the Soviet Union and is now trying to reclaim its large role in world politics. But you wrote that there were humanitarian and political dimensions to the exchange. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
So humanitarian dimension is quite clear, but the political dimension is that this exchange, in fact, creates some sort of mechanism that could be used in the future. And this mechanism means that, well, you have the real Russian spies or killers who are targeting Russian dissidents abroad, who will know in the future that they have some guarantee to be exchanged by the Russian state. And the Russian state, in the same time, will know for sure that they can arrest any random citizen of United States or Germany or some other, let's say, Western country and use this person to exchange him to their spies, let's say FSB, you know, agents and so on. So basically it could work in the future like some sort of conveyor, you know, of exchange where the Russian secret services will act more or less with the guarantee that they will escape from the punishment for their actions. And that is pretty sad, and politically it's very bad. Because if we look on this German and American citizens who were arrested, you can see that these people, they are absolutely randomly chosen to be exchanged. For example, one German guy who was a part of this exchange, he was arrested in St. Petersburg only because he had marijuana gummies. Of course, it was not smart for him to to take it to Russia. But anyway, you can see the real value of these people.
It's really crazy. So maybe you want to comment on that, Grusha, but I also want to go ahead and you comment on that because I want to comment on it as well.
I just also wanted to say about the way the exchange was staged. You could see that it was prepared as a big show.
Yeah,
with both parties participating in the show. Though we know that there are prisoner exchanges which are happening on the regular basis between Russia and Ukraine. And those exchanges are not held in the same way. They are done in a more routine manner. And that is not drawing any attention to itself. While this particular exchange was staged as a great performance with people being kidnapped or taken without themselves knowing what was going to happen, as happened with all the people who were exchanged by the Russian side. Then their relatives didn't know where they were. Their lawyers didn't know where they were. So anything could have happened to them during that time. And there were concerns about their lives. And of course, that was a way for Russia to show again that actually we can do anything with those people. What is more, as it was claimed by Yashin, for example, there were two more people on the list. Alexei Gorina, who was a political activist, part of Yashin's campaign, also part of the district council in Moscow. And another person is Kolodny, who was the member of Navalny's team and was with Navalny in his trial. So these two people were supposed to be part of the exchange, but Russians just didn't bring them to the plane. And I'm saying what Yashin is saying. So there was the point where there was a choice. Either the swap is not happening or it has to happen without those two people. For example, Gorinov is a way to exert pressure on Yashin. And Gorinov is much older. He is over 60 and he has a lot of different complications and health problems. So this is one person. And the other, Kolodny, is a way to exert pressure on Navalny's team. So that is done in a little bit of a mafia style, as Putin likes to do things. You can also see the mafia style and the way he kisses and hugs all the thugs that he sends abroad and the killers. So like in that attitude, of course, there is a big difference with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's really interesting because as you were speaking, I was thinking you were saying that it was a mistake that those two weren't included, but you're kind of showing, and that perhaps there were some, you know, who didn't participate in the right way by getting them to the point of exchange, but you're actually saying something quite different. And all of it is so cynical because it really shows, and I'd like to get your take on that. In this case, Putin sees political prisoners as financial assets or as assets to be used in this game to get people out of the West. And whereas perhaps in the past, we've seen nations trying to punish others or deal with others by freezing their assets or, you know, threatening various things. Now, Putin is actually using humans as pawns. And it's perhaps not so surprising, but incredibly cynical. So I guess that raises the question of, you know, is whether this will become a regular thing now that we will see more and more people snatched on whatever pretext, only to be used for later exchanges. And so I guess that also means what happens to those who are left behind and whether or not this makes it worse for them. Is there any hope or is this just something quite separate?
Yeah, I think that here in this mechanism that was created by this exchange, the initiative is always on the side of Putin. So if he think that there is someone really important who is imprisoned in any Western country, he could find someone to exchange for this important person. So the mechanism will work like this. There is no other way how it will work. So it definitely will not work in this way that the United States or European Union will propose some more political prisoners to be exchanged for someone who is not really interesting for Putin. Yes, so that's why I think from political point of view, what happened is pretty bad. Also because even 16 political prisoners were released. That is very good for them. But they were released not because of international campaign, not because of any public pressure from below. They were released just because they jumped up against their own will in some very complicated situation.
You know, it's worth saying and asking as well, you know, that the most powerful voice in the press conference that was held the very next day in Germany between Karamurza, Yashin, and Karamurza, of course, speaks English and he is more well known, and his voice was very important. He thanked the governments of the United States and Germany. He vowed that he will go back to Russia. But I think the most powerful voice was that of Ilya Yashin, who was crying, "I don't want to be and die a migrant. I don't want to be exchanged. I didn't want to be exchanged. I was forcibly deported from my country." And he stressed that the Russian Constitution bans sending a citizen of the Russian Federation abroad without his consent. And he said, "As a Russian citizen, I confirm that I do not give my permission to be sent outside of Russia." And he further revealed that the Russian authorities made it clear that his return would block any potential exchanges of any other political prisoners for the foreseeable future. So, you know, as you said, Ilya, there were others who were in far worse health, who should have taken his place in the exchange. And he did mention the case of Boris Kargalitsky specifically. But, you know, given that choice, you know, he's in a horrible position. He can go back and go back to prison, but it will mean, at least if the threat is real, that others, you know, will die. So can you talk a little bit about Ilya Yashin and who he is and what he represents and this particular case where, you know, once before in an interview, you cautioned me when I started to say something about things going against Russian law. And you kind of said, look, there's no legality in any of this. But given that, let me hear your views on it.
So first of all, Ilya Yashin is the most well-known politician among these three people who were on this press conference. In Russia, he is the most well-known because he is a long-time activist of the liberal opposition since early 2000s. So I personally remembered him in some 20 years back in that time, and he was already quite active in the anti-Putin opposition. He is very straight in his opinion, very open in his opinion. He never compromised with the authoritarian system in Russia. Of course, he has his own views. He is not a left-wing person. He is like classic Russian liberal, mostly focused on the questions of democracy, human rights, and so on, not so much free market. And he spent a lot of time in extra-parliamentary street politics in Russia, trying to participate in various elections in Russia. One moment, he was elected on the local level and he became head of municipality of one of the districts of Moscow for several years. I will say that after Alexei Navalny, he is the most well-known liberal oppositionist politician in Russia. And you are absolutely right when you mentioned that he he refused to sign petition of pardon for Putin, as well as Karamurza, as well as Pivovarov, as well of most of the people who were released because of this exchange. Actually, I just saw the press conference of Oleg Orlov in Berlin. It's another person who was released because of this exchange, and he is one of the leaders of Memorial. He is quite old, 71 or 72, and you can imagine that prison was definitely not good for his health. So he also was very clear on this press conference. He said that he refused to sign this petition of pardon, and he never agreed for this type of exchange, especially if he will know that people like Alexei Gorinov, they are not included in this exchange. And he also said that he had no plan to leave the country, and he wants to go back in any possibility. But as Ilya Yashin, Orlov also said that if he will go back now, it will crush the possibility for further exchanges that could bring freedom for other political prisoners in Russia. So you can see that all these people, they find themselves in a kind of dead end. Because, of course, all of them, they didn't agree to be a part of such an exchange. They refused to ask for a pardon. And all of them, they understand that they should stay abroad because they are now became hostages of some other possibilities of exchange with the cost of lives of the Russian political prisoners.
Did you want to add to that, Grusha?
I can add a little bit about what this could represent in a way for the Russian opposition, which is now quite represented abroad. Of course, as there was the criticism that you just read out at the beginning of the show, that these people would turn into some sort of talking heads and that they will be on YouTube and that it won't be useful at all. First of all, I want to raise doubts about how unuseful YouTube is. Because in Russia, almost like the overwhelming majority of the Russian population, say 70%, watch YouTube. Right now, YouTube is being slowed down by the Russian authorities. Now it's almost official. So that means that people have limits using or having access to YouTube. Of course, right now you can still access it using VPN and are helping people inside Russia to get information they need. It's not as useless as you might think it is, because in the situation where the whole information is being controlled by the state, so there is nothing that could be different from the official position of the Kremlin that can be voiced on the Russian television, on different news platforms, in newspapers, on the radio, in your kindergarten, at school, anywhere. So YouTube and internet are the only means people can get access to something else. The other thing, of course, is that Yashin, as I see, is a more sort of well-known figure for the people in Russia and some kind of momentum for the Russian opposition right now. Just today, Yashin was meeting with his supporters in Berlin. And this meeting was taking place in a park, and more than 5,000 people registered to take part in it because it was open to everyone. So I think there is certain momentum right now, and it's up to us how we use it.
You know, I think the question is what happens now inside Russia in terms of not just expressing political opposition, but in campaigning for those who have been left behind. Now, in the press conferences, they mentioned that they were called out of their prisons and asked to sign a petition for a pardon from Putin, and they did not do that. The same thing has been raised with Boris Kagarlitsky, and he does not want to do that, nor does he ever want. He's very firm. He does not want to be part of any foreign exchange. Ilya, in one of your Telegram posts, you asked about the fear or even the stain of leaving the country. And that, of course, in terms of Kagarlitsky and Yashin, it's very clearly about being able to act politically in Russia.
Yeah, it's a big question, Susie, because you can say that, well, you are a Russian politician, you have to stay in Russia, whatever it costs, even in prison. But look, Alexei Navalny, during last year when he was alive, he was nearly isolated, even from his lawyers. He was not able to communicate with his comrades, as well as Ilya Yashin in the last half of a year before this exchange. His contacts were quite limited. And I'm pretty afraid that that could happen with many other political prisoners who still have the opportunity, like Boris Kagarlitsky, for letters exchange. Basically, you deal with a system which doesn't respect any rights, which doesn't follow any laws. In this sense, it's a problem. So if some kind of moral stance that I refuse to leave the country, I prefer to stay in prison, really make political sense. Because, well, if you look at the history of Russian Revolution back in the early 20th century, you had most of people like Lenin, Trotsky, Plekhanov, or whatever, who spent years and years in immigration, and they spent these years quite politically effective, let's say. Of course, it's a very precise question that very much depends on the exact context and even exact personal situation. So it's hard to give any advice, but I believe that if we take this idea as the kind of universal ethic for every political dissident in Russia, that is something controversial about it. And it should be discussed if it is a real right, position to stay in prison by any means. And of course, the other important thing that most of Russian political prisoners, and now you have hundreds of political prisoners in Russia, they have no such a choice. They were arrested immediately. They were not asked if they want to write a petition of a pardon for president or not. They were just put in jail for years. I believe that for most of them, the question of their freedom is quite important, and maybe it's more important than some moral or political general thoughts.
There's a lot that you raised there, and I want to talk about. There's one thing, though, that you mentioned, that Yashin is very much more well-known inside Russia than, say, Karamurza, who, because of his wife and campaigning abroad, is quite well-known abroad. And I wonder if there's any way to account for the way various prisoners are treated. He was certainly, they tried to poison Karamurza twice, and he was held, I think, a year in solitary or in the punishment cell. Really harsh conditions. And it seems like, again, this is just arbitrary. Is this, does it have much to do with their threat, or just does it come from on high to treat this person like this? Or is it up to the penal colony that they're in and the officers there? Do we know anything about that? Either one of you, if you could talk about the treatment of political prisoners and who gets treated worse than others and why.
Yeah, Ilya, maybe you answer why some prisoners are treated better than other prisoners. But I think, Susie, you more or less expressed our own guesses. So if they are punished, it is more of a signal to the public. But at the same time, a lot of things happen just because the penal colony authorities are used to doing things in their own way. So there are these different factors that intervene. For example, one of the persons who is considered a political prisoner is Yegor Belozekin from St. Petersburg. And he threw a Molotov cocktail at a conscription office, which didn't explode. So nothing happened. But Yegor got a 7 years term in jail for extremism. So he himself was declared he was declared a person who was carrying out a terrorist attack, similar to that one, which was carried out by people in the Krakow City Hall, that place where, as you've heard, almost 150 people died. So in that situation, you can see that there is a certain way that the Russian state qualifies people who are threatening Putin's military operation or in a way express their opposition to the regime. So Yegor today, he was being transferred to a different colony from the place where he was before. And on the way there, he had to freeze basically on the way. So he was not given anything to cover himself. And then he got into a cell confinement cell where he couldn't get any of his medication that he needs. And he also had to stay in this kind of really horrible conditions with no sanitary norms being complied with. So all of that, and important fact, Yegor is 17. So he was a schoolboy, basically. He is still in jail and he's not, like, he wasn't included in any lists. And there are just so many people just who are in Russian jails today, and they are very unlikely to make it to any list. Even the list of political prisoners, which counts almost 1,300 people today, and those are people who are in jail right now, that list is completely non-exhaustive because the procedure for qualifying a person as a political prisoner takes a long time, and it has to such agencies as Amnesty International, etc. So if those agencies do not qualify that person as a political prisoner for some reason, and then it also, there has to be someone who can write an appeal for that person to be considered a political prisoner. And a lot of people just don't have that possibility. So that means that the number of so-called political prisoners is much greater in Russia than those estimates, the official estimates that we have.
Why don't we just do this right here? I have a lot of questions still that are political about activity abroad. But Grusha, since you raised the issue of a few of these political prisoners, people listening to this broadcast may want to help in some way. And I know you're involved in the Letters Across Borders, Right to Russian Political Prisoners. Can you just say something to our listeners and explain what that does? Every one of them, by the way, in their press conferences, Yashin, Karamursa, Pivarova, if I said that right, mentioned that getting letters is just incredibly important, and they got thousands of them. So maybe you could say something about that.
There is an NGO, which is called OVD Info, and they just launched a new project, which is called Vesticha, or The Message. And this project allows you to open their website, OVD Info website, and there you can click on this new function, which is Vesticha. It will give you automatically the name of the prisoner that you can write to. And this is completely free of charge. So you can write the letter and you won't have to go through the prison mail service. So that means that you won't have to enter any of your personal data, etc., except your name. And then the new service will send you the response if the prisoner writes you one. So this project is targeted specifically at people who do not get letters. So of course there are people who are known, and then they can get thousands of letters, but there are also political prisoners who still haven't got a single letter, while they're in confinement. So this project, the idea is to get us to write letters to all political prisoners so no one of them gets no attention. So this is a wonderful project that they started. And I also think what is possible, and we already tried this at UC Berkeley, we organized a session of writing letters to political prisoners. And that is something that everyone can do. And I think with this new service, it can be done much easier. And this is also a possibility, if you can, to get together and to read the stories of people who were arrested. So you can go to several websites. You can go to Memorial website, where they have the fullest list of political prisoners. You can go to OVD Info, and you can go to Solidarity Zone, because Solidarity Zone orientation is a little bit different from all others, because they deal with cases of terrorism and extremism. And that can mean basically anything, but people who are charged with terrorism and extremism are more unlikely to get the status of political prisoners.
It's a really great initiative. And for those of you who might do it and say maybe you wouldn't know what to say, you can write about absolutely anything. Just getting a letter and knowing that someone is writing to that person, and you will probably get a letter back. And this makes it so much easier. I tried in the past to write to Kagarlitsky. And of course, if you use the prison system, you have to put all kinds of data. It has to be in Russian. You pay by the word. And then in the end, they don't accept any payment from any source of currency or credit card outside of Russia. So after I did it several times, I realized I just gave up because it was so difficult. So this is really good that there's now this service. And you should go to OVD-info, OVD hyphen info to find this project. Now, I wanted to, in the time remaining, talk about the situation for political activity abroad of Russians, because so many people who are critical have left the country. You could call it a political brain drain in some ways, but many, many are still active like yourselves and working on the situation. And the regime has this, you know, I don't know if it what we could call it. It is so surreal that they label certain people foreign agents. And in Russia, that means if every time you read anything about or from someone who's been designated a foreign agent, they have to first list that. And then, you know, they're free to say what they want, but it usually carries with it a danger of being arrested. But I'm curious to get your understanding of why people abroad are also being labeled foreign agents. Does that mean that they're in danger from the tentacles of oppression that Putin uses abroad? You know, extra judicial killings? What does it mean?
By the way, it's interesting that in this text that you read, from Russian oppositionist B, he mentioned like foreign agent Boris Kagarlitsky, foreign agent Ilya Yashin. So he did it because it's the only legal way to mention these names if you are in Russia. So if you will write like Boris Kagarlitsky without mentioning that he is foreign agent, you could be fined. It's a violation with the law. Of course, people who just left Russia like 2 or 3 years ago, they are still Russian citizens. They still have their relatives in Russia. And of course, labeling them a foreign agent, firstly, it's great opportunity to damage their life, even abroad. Secondly, it's a way to alienate them from the Russian society. And that is much more important because that's the, let's say, the deep ideological meaning of this label, foreign agent, that there is a Putin who will decide who is a true Russian and who is just agent of some other country. So I think that this process of alienation of the activists of opposition is very important for regime. And of course, they are trying to break, to cut any ties with the Russian society from these people. That is clear indication that this Russian opposition abroad, this recent Russian immigration, pose some sort of threat for the regime. So you have this kind of, let's say, not fear, but concern about their activity abroad. And I think the mission of the Russian opposition abroad could be directed in two ways. So one is this contact with this touch with the Russian society in different ways, through the social media, through YouTube or whatever. And the second direction is the spreading the information about the real situation in Russia, about the real conditions of Russian political prisoners, like in the countries where they settled after their immigration. That's the only way how to change this very problematic practice of exchange between the states under very unclear conditions, where the political prisoners became just the assets in some hidden process of trade between the states. So the society, let's say the people from below, should massively intervene in this process. And I believe that the Russian immigration could play a critical role in this.
I have a final question, but about what this exchange and the entire, you know, situation in Russia means in terms of Putin's strength or weakness. But before we do that, I want to give Grusha another chance to talk more about stories of prisoners so that our listeners get a better sense of what kind of people are held, how old they are, what the conditions are, what their so-called crimes are, how effective it's been in silencing any expression of opposition to Putin's brutal war. Grusha, can you come in and tell us a little bit?
Thank you, Susie. Of course, I just want to note that it will be much better if those who listen to this show go to the websites that I listed before and just check out the stories of people who are now being political prisoners or put into Russian jails for their opposition to the war in Ukraine. One of the stories that just happened recently, it happened right before the exchange took place. A pianist from the town of Birbijan, so it's very far away in Russia, and this pianist, Pavel Kushner, he was 39, and he was arrested in late May because he recorded videos on YouTube. Those were very short videos. There were four of them where he declared that people should not be afraid, that political prisoners should be released, and that Russia should stop its criminal war in Ukraine. So just some very simple messages. The number of views that he had was very little. It was less than 100 views. And still, he was arrested and put into jail. He didn't even have the trial yet. So he was in the sort of pre-trial detention. And he went on a hunger strike. On the 27th of July, he died.
Yeah, this is just awful.
This person, we would probably not hear about him anymore because he is not in the lists anymore. But he has done something that is the act of bravery, and it is the act that he performed out of his civic duty. Whether he was on the left or he wasn't on the left, I think in this particular situation, what he did does matter. And it is a very big question for me, how to make the lives of these people matter. And I think it is our responsibility to make sense out of their very senseless death. And the other person I know personally, and because we particularly has now left Russia, but he was one of the candidates for the Russian State Duma. And Dmitry Ivanov was part of this campaign. He was also a university activist. And on the 5th of August, so just recently, he celebrated his 25th birthday. He spent 2 years in jail already. And he himself claimed that he would refuse to be exchanged if he was offered this. In his recent post, he also talks about the actual number of political prisoners. And he is saying that the official number is just the tip of the iceberg, because he saw just so many people in jail with him who were put there because of posting a video on their Facebook page or writing a post. Just think about how easy it is to get into jail. I will end with the case of Zarema Musayeva, an elderly woman, and she is the mother of Ibrahim Abubakar and Baysangur Yanbulbayev, all of whom have fled the country citing harassment from Chechen authorities over their online criticism of Kremlin-backed Chechen head Ramzan Kadyrov. So the Chechen police and security officers detained their mother, Zarema Musayeva, in January 2022 in her apartment in Nizhny Novgorod, which is 1,800 kilometers away from Chechnya, and Grozny is capital. In July, the court in Chechnya sentenced Musayeva to 5.5 years in prison on charges of fraud and attacking a police officer, which Musayeva and her supporters have denied. Human rights groups have said that Musayeva needs proper medical assistance, as she has an acute form of diabetes, a cataract, so she practically cannot see, and a constant pain in her knee. So the Russian state is torturing Zarema Musayeva, who did nothing but give birth to her children who oppose Ramzan Kadyrov. And many more stories are there, the situation in Chechnya and constant kidnappings of women. And all of that has to be talked about. And I think just here, I want to mention and continue Ilya's point about what the Russian opposition can do abroad and what can be most effective. I think, well, first of all, of course, one practical aspect wasn't mentioned, that a lot of people went to different countries and they had to leave everything behind. So that means that sometimes people don't have documents. They have a very dubious legal status. They also may not have sufficient money, neither the knowledge of the language of the countries where they are. So this is very important for the Russian opposition and for our counterparts and our comrades abroad to find the way to help those Russians who have to flee the regime to at least have the basic needs satisfied, not speaking about participating in political activity, which I think is the reason why they wanted to flee, except for the fact that their life was threatened. And one more important thing is that I think the student campaigns and the popular campaigns in the U.S. against the war in Gaza has shown that people in the U.S. and their actions matter, because they managed to exert pressure on their government. And I think this is very inspiring, and especially when it comes to giving support to people in other countries who are fighting against their government. In this particular situation, Putin's regime wants to talk only to the U.S. administration. So the pressure that is exerted on the U.S. administration to make Russia move towards the release of political prisoners, this is what the international solidarity campaign has to do if we want to be not simply objects in those exchanges, but to become their subjects.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. And it gives, of course, everybody a lot to think about and to do. And I want to thank both of you for joining me today. We'll certainly come back and ask you more, because it's an ongoing situation, but we've really run out of time. Ilya Budryanskis is a political theorist and activist. He is currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley, but we're speaking to him in Europe today. And his book is Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. And you should check out his Telegram channel, Brave New World. Grusha Galayeva is the managing editor of Postly, which has a double meaning. It means after the Russian invasion, but also signifies after, as in what's next. That's online. You can easily find that. She's the author of many articles, including a really good one, more recent, called Navalny and Us. And she's joining us also from somewhere in Europe. I want to thank both of you for joining me on the program today.
Thank you so much, Susie.
Thanks.
Thank you, Susie.
I'm back here, and I'm joined by Alan Minsky. He is no stranger to our airwaves. He spent many years as our program director, and he is now the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And I think you can guess it, but we're here to ask you for your support. And it's a really important message that we bring you. KPFK, and part of the Pacifica Foundation, is not funded by, as you know, corporations or anything else. We are entirely a listener-sponsored radio station, not a listener-supported radio station. We don't ask for your support along with a bunch of underwriting, but we just ask for your sponsorship. And this is the time that we need you to do it. So we're going to ask you to call in at 818-985-5735 and support this radio station and specifically this program, Beneath the Surface. And I'm going to let Alan talk to you for just a second. But I want to say that, you know, I've been on the air for a very long time. And of late, I've been sort of specializing, almost by default, on topics that I feel we can go into some depth on. One of them, of course, is in my own area of, let's call it expertise, and that's the former Soviet Union and Russia. Putin is as more repressive than we could have imagined, and so I've been covering a lot of that, and also labor, which I continue to cover. And these are kinds of topics that, you know, are not necessarily covered even on our own radio station in any kind of depth. So I have nothing but fun bringing them to you. And we'd like to hear your support for it. Alan?
Oh, well, just I hope people right now just pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. They can go to kpfk.org, make a donation, maybe, you know, make a note that it's for Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. I have learned so much from this show. I mean, I can't believe the wealth of insight, knowledge, and historical background, and just everything that provides a strong foundation for intellectual understanding of the present I have received from Beneath the Surface. And getting to work with Susie on the show has been an incredible privilege for me. For me, working on it, and for you, the listeners, getting to hear it, this is as good information as you can get to understand the world we live in any university graduate course anywhere in the world. I mean, who other than Mike Davis is the great author about the history, the real history, with understanding of Southern California? And where did Mike Davis's interviews appear in the media in Southern California? They were on Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman more than any other show. That's just one example. Incredible, incredible insight on this show. All of it placed inside the framework of the history that we're all living in this globalized world. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Call now. Please, please, please support Beneath the Surface.
And thank you so much, Alan Minsky. And I'm Susie Weissman. Remember, support the station and call in your pledge. 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org. Thanks so much. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guests, Ilya Budraitskis and Grusha Galayeva. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, to producer director Melissa Figueroa, and our editor and engineer Juliana Gota. And thanks to Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. And there's more information about our program and our guests on our Facebook page, which is Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio, for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Weissman.
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry.
Support comes from a celebration of folk music, August 17th and 18th, live at the Greek Theater. Performing artists include folk music's early pioneers, the Kingston Trio, and the Limelighters, with additional performances by the Hot Licks, the music of Dan Hicks, the John Stewart Band, plus special guest renowned tenor banjo player Cynthia Sayer. For more information and tickets, visit GreekTheater.com or KPFK.org.
Hi, KPFK listeners. This is Abby Martin.
And this is Mike Preisner. We're the creators of the political documentary series, The Empire Files.
We're also longtime listeners and supporters of KPFK. That's why we're so